Hello, it's Debbie, back again on Wednesday. This is Wednesday, March 23rd, 2016, with the e-edition of the Herald and Review of Decatur, starting with World, Islamic State Claims Deadly Brussels Bombing, from the AP in Brussels. Islamic extremists struck Tuesday in the heart of Europe, killing at least 34 people and wounding scores of others in back-to-back bombings of the Brussels airport and subway that again laid bare the continent's vulnerability to suicide squads. Bloodied and dazed travelers staggered from the airport after two explosions, at least one blamed on a suicide attacker and another apparently on a suitcase bomb, tore through crowds checking in for morning flights. About 40 minutes later, another rush hour blast ripped through a subway car in central Brussels as it left the Malbec station in the heart of the European Union's capital city. Authorities released a photo taken from closed-circuit TV footage of three men pushing luggage carts in the airport, saying two of them apparently were suicide bombers, and that the third, dressed in a light-colored coat, black hat, and glasses, was at large. They urged the public to reach out to police if they recognized him. The two men believed to be the suicide attackers apparently were wearing dark gloves on their left hands, possibly to hide detonators. In police raids Tuesday across Belgium, authorities later found a nail-filled bomb, chemical products, and an Islamic State flag in a house in the Schierbeck neighborhood, the state prosecutor's office said in a statement. In its claim of responsibility, the Islamic State group said its members detonated suicide vests both at the airport and the subway, where many passengers fled to safety down dark tunnels filled with hazy smoke from the explosion. A small child wailed, and commuters used cell phones to light their way out. European security officials have been bracing for a major attack for weeks and warned that Islamic State was actively preparing to strike. The arrest Friday of Salah Abdeslam, a key suspect in the November 13th attacks in Paris, heightened those fears as investigators said many more people were involved than originally thought and that some were still on the loose. In this time of tragedy, this black moment for our country, I appeal to everyone to remain calm, but also to show solidarity, said Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel, who announced 3 days of mourning in his country's deadliest terror strike. Last year it was Paris, today it's Brussels. It's the same attack, said French President Francois Hollande. Shockwaves from the attacks crossed Europe and the Atlantic, prompting heightened security at airports and other sites. Belgium raised its terror alert to the highest level, shut the airport through Wednesday, and ordered a citywide lockdown, deploying about 500 soldiers onto Brussels' largely empty streets to bolster police checkpoints. France and Belgium both reinforced border security. Justice ministers and interior ministers from across the 28-nation EU planned an emergency meeting, possibly Thursday morning, to assess the fallout. The subway blast hit beneath buildings that normally host EU meetings and house the union's top leadership. The bombings came barely 4 months after suicide attackers based in Brussels' heavily Muslim Molenbeek district slaughtered 130 people at Paris night spots, and intelligence agencies had warned for months a follow-up strike was inevitable. Paris fugitive Abdeslam was arrested in Molenbeek. A high-level Belgian judicial official said a connection by Abdeslam to Tuesday's attacks is a lead to pursue. The official spoke on condition of anonymity because the investigation was ongoing. Abdeslam has told investigators he was planning to restart something from Brussels, said Belgium Foreign Minister Didier Reynders. He said Sunday that authorities took the claim seriously because we found a lot of weapons, heavy weapons, in the first investigations, and we have seen a new network of people around him in Brussels. While Belgium authorities knew that some kind of extremist act was being prepared in Europe, we never could have imagined something of this scale, Belgium Interior Minister Jan Jambon said. Officials at the airport in the Brussels suburb of Zaventem said police had discovered a Kalashnikov assault rifle and explosives-packed vest abandoned at the facility, offering one potential lead for forensic evidence. Bomb disposal experts safely dismantled that explosive device. a U.S. administration official said American intelligence officers were working with their European counterparts to try to identify the apparently skilled bomb maker or makers involved in the Brussels attack and to identify any links to the bombs used in Paris. The official, who wasn't authorized to speak publicly on the investigations and demanded anonymity, told the AP that at least one of the bombs at the airport was suspected to have been packed into a suitcase left in the departures hall. Three intelligence officials in Iraq told the AP they had warned European colleagues last month of IS plans to attack airports and trains, although Belgium wasn't specified as a likely target. The officials who monitor activities in the IS stronghold of Raqqa, Syria, said Brussels may have become a target because of the arrest of Abdeslam. One of the officials, all of whom spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to talk about their knowledge of ISIS operations, said Iraqi intelligence officials believe that three other IS activists remain at large in Brussels and are plotting other suicide bomb attacks. European leaders, already struggling to cope with a wave of migration from the war-torn Middle East, said they must rely on better anti-terrorist intelligence work to identify an enemy that wears no uniforms and seeks the softest of targets. They emphasized that Europe must remain tolerant toward Muslims as they seek to identify those on the violent extremist fringe. Leaders of the 28-nation EU said in a joint statement that Tuesday's assault on Brussels only strengthens our resolve to defend European values and tolerance from the attacks of the intolerant. The UN lead official for Middle East refugees, Amin Awad, warned that Europe faced an increasing risk of racist retaliation against Muslim immigrant communities. Any sort of hostilities because of the Brussels attack or Paris attack is misplaced, Awad said. End of that AP article. Next article is by Dan Pirella, the Springfield bureau chief for Herald and Review. No action on budget negotiations. Rahner seeks one-on-one meeting with Madigan. Out of Springfield. The article's out of Springfield. Despite losses last week in key primary races into which he and his allies poured record-breaking sums of money, Governor Bruce Rahner is cautioning against reading too much into the election results. The Republican governor and supporters helped drive spending in two primaries, a Democratic race in the Chicago House District and a Republican race in a downstate Senate district, to a combined $10 million. The candidates aligned with Rahner, Representative Ken Duncan, Democrat Chicago, and GOP challenger Bryce Benton, lost by wide margins to Juliana Stratton and Senator Sam McCann, Republican Plainview, respectively. I think it's a mistake to read much into any one election for any one candidate in the legislature, Rahner said Tuesday at a news conference at the Illinois State Fairgrounds to promote a bill that would create a private foundation to help support fair facilities in Springfield and Des Moines. Each election has its own unique characteristics, its own candidates, its own issues, its own local challenges. There has been talk in Springfield for months that the state's budget impasse, which will enter its 10th month April 1st, could be resolved after the March 15th primaries, but neither side seems poised to change its tack. I don't think getting a budget deal should really be tied to any particular election or primary event or a general election, Rahner said. I hope we'll get a budget deal as part of a compromise on a bipartisan basis to do what's right for the people of Illinois. The governor reiterated his call for a compromise that would include some possible revenues, some expense cuts, as well as reforms. I've said I'm open to considering a tax increase as part of a grand compromise, he said. I'm willing to compromise on virtually anything. Rahner repeated his call for instituting term limits for legislators, changing the way their districts are drawn, and allowing local governments to decide what issues they negotiate with their workers, among other policy priorities. He said voters of both parties overwhelmingly back these ideas. His office didn't provide information supporting those statements. A recent poll from the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University showed large majorities of voters supporting elements of Rahner's agenda, but the governor and his staff were dismissive of the same poll's finding that half the voters disapprove of his job performance. Rather than calling another meeting with the four party leaders in the General Assembly to craft a budget deal, Rauner said he focused on trying to meet one-on-one with House Speaker Michael Madigan, Democrat, Chicago, on whom he has repeatedly and publicly placed the blame for the impasse. The governor said his staff reached out to Madigan's last week and as of Tuesday morning had yet to hear back. Madigan spokesman Steve Brown said he had no ability to confirm that claim. Members of the General Assembly's Democratic majority blame Rauner for the impasse because he vetoed all but the elementary and secondary education portion of this year's budget and because they say he insists on including non-budget issues in negotiations. At the fairgrounds, Rauner urged Madigan to allow the foundation bill to advance in the House. It would allow a private nonprofit organization to raise money to support the two fairgrounds, which together have a backlog of $180 million in deferred maintenance projects. Rauner noted that Missouri, Iowa, Indiana, and Wisconsin all have private foundations that support their state fairs. "We can't overly rely on state funds to maintain these facilities," he said, standing in front of a barn with holes in its roof. "We've got to come up with creative solutions that don't pressure our taxpayers anymore." Madigan has been skeptical of such arrangements in the past, even setting up a task force this spring to look into the agreement between the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity and the newly formed Illinois Business and Economic Development Corp. End of that article. On to the third of four articles from the front page. National. Clinton email case unlikely to net charges. This is by AP out of Washington. Asked earlier this month whether she'd be indicted over her use of a private email server as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton responded, "It's not going to happen." Though Republicans characterized her response as hubris, several legal experts interviewed by the Associated Press agree with the frontrunner for the Democratic presidential nomination. The relatively few laws that govern the handling of classified materials were so generally written to cover spies, leakers, and those who illegally retain such information, such as at home. Though the view is not unanimous, several lawyers who specialize in this area said it's a stretch to apply to existing statutes to a former cabinet secretary whose communication of sensitive material was with aides, not a national enemy. During her tenure as the nation's top diplomat between 2009 and 2013, Clinton's work emails were routed through a private computer server located in the basement of her New York home. The State Department now concedes that a small percentage of those messages contained sensitive national security information, including some later determined to be top secret. Computer security experts say the arrangement could have left the messages vulnerable to hackers, including those working for foreign intelligence agencies. Clinton has called her decision to rely on a home server a mistake, but has also repeatedly asserted that none of the messages were marked as classified when she sent or received them. The FBI has for months been investigating whether the sensitive information that flowed through Clinton's email server was mishandled. The Inspector General at the State Department has been reviewing the issue. Regardless of the outcome, there's no question the probes have created a major distraction as Clinton campaigns for her party's nomination. One potentially relevant statute carrying up to a year in prison makes it a crime to knowingly remove classified information and retain it at an unauthorized location. Former CIA Director David Petraeus pleaded guilty to that misdemeanor offense last year after providing 8 black binders of classified information to his biographer. He was sentenced to 2 years probation as part of a plea deal, and the prosecutors made it clear in that case that Petraeus knew he was turning over highly classified information. With Clinton, though, I look at something which requires knowledge, and the first question I got to ask is, how do they prove knowledge? Said Bill Jeffress, a Washington criminal defense lawyer. Well, knowledge that information is classified is a critical component. It's likely still be established even in the absence of classification markings on an email in question, said Nathan Sales, a Syracuse University law professor who used to work at the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security and who thinks the investigation raises important legal issues. Sometimes information is so obviously sensitive that you can infer knowledge from the content, in which the lack of markings may not matter for the purpose of establishing liability, Sales said. A separate law makes it a felony to handle national defense information with gross negligence, by causing it to be removed from its proper place of custody or to be lost, stolen, or destroyed. But that statute is part of the Espionage Act, a law used against former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden that generally was intended for people the government believes intended to harm U.S. national interests. Proving gross negligence requires showing an act was more than just a mistake. Brad Moss, a Washington lawyer who deals regularly with security clearance matters, said the Justice Department could conceivably look to bring charges in the Clinton email case, but prosecutors would have to try to decide if they really want to take that gamble. Inquiries into mishandling of classified information generally end with a security clearance revocation rather than a criminal charge, he said. But Ronald Sievert, a former federal prosecutor and a University of Texas adjunct law professor, said an argument could be made that Clinton's creation of a private email server amounted to gross negligence. It's a jury issue, Sievert said. End of that article. Fourth article on the front page is a little more upbeat. Macon County Farm Bureau reaches century mark. Decatur. This is by Chris Lisvardi. For the past 100 years, the Macon County Farm Bureau has been striving to represent its members partially by raising awareness on various levels about the agricultural industry. Despite continual advances in technology, the group's mission has remained much the same as when it was founded March 23, 1916, just a couple months after the statewide Illinois Agricultural Association organization, commonly known as the Illinois Farm Bureau, was formed. Insurance was offered to Farm Bureau members as a way of spreading the risk to grow crops. As its membership increased, farmers gained a powerful collective voice, which continues to exist, advocating on behalf of the industry. It's a strong voice for agriculture, said Paul Butler, a farmer from Macon. I don't know any other organization out there like it. Butler decided to join the Macon County Farm Bureau after starting to farm more than a decade ago. It's a decision that's paid off for Butler, who has become involved through the Farm Bureau advocating the agricultural industry on legislative issues while gathering information about growing crops on a local level. Butler said he became interested in the Farm Bureau simply because he wanted its weekly newspaper with ads for equipment, but it has meant more to him than that. I knew then 10% of what I know now, Butler said. There's nothing like the face-to-face connections you can make. Some farmers join because of the Farm Bureau's connections with country insurance. However, past president and longtime member Mike Stacy of Iliopolis said Farm Bureau provides benefits from being a grassroots member-driven organization. The benefits extend beyond just farmers, he said. It affects all of us, Stacy said. If commodity prices go up, it can impact food prices. The economical price of food in this country speaks highly of farmers. Macon County is one of the top producing areas of the state, with farmers growing mostly corn and soybeans, along with producing other crops such as wheat and Christmas trees. Farming has been shown to contribute over $15 billion, or 62.2% of the county's total economy, mostly from crop-related activity. Farmers take pride in their work, knowing that what they do contributes to the feeding of the world, just like what their ancestors did, said Rob Albers of Blue Mound. I could be standing an 80-acre field that my great-grandfather stood in before me, Albers said. There aren't that many occupations where that's the case. It means the world to me. Members can become involved early on in their careers through the Young Leaders Group, as current President Ed Leonard Jr. of Niantic did when he started with Farm Bureau. The Ag in the Classroom program starts by attempting to spark the interest in the agriculture among children. Leonard said Agucation is a key component of the County Farm Bureau's educational efforts. Agucation, A-G-U-C-A-T-I-O-N. The Farm Bureau invites area fifth graders to Richland Community College for Agucation each spring, to explore various aspects of farming, such as seeing a combine or interacting with livestock. It's amazing how many people around us don't get what we do, Leonard said. It's not just who live in the city. People in the country can see a combine or tractor and don't think much about it. The group marked its anniversary last week with the Ag Day luncheon, with more plans for later in the year, including this summer during its annual meeting. The Macon County Farm Bureau will continue to offer the types of programs its members ask for, particularly for young farmers who face decisions about whether to remain in farming, manager Tim Stock said. We want them to continue to do that, Stock said. We want to help them stay in the family business and grow and prosper while doing so. Coming back to the farm is not as easy as it once was. Stock said young farmers are often looking for the social aspect of what the group provides to them, such as making contacts to share ideas about farming. For older members, Stock said the Farm Bureau's Prime Timers group offers trips and an opportunity to talk with others about agriculture. Most Farm Bureau members aren't actively farming, Stock said. He said they receive benefits such as discount programs, but show their support for agriculture by being an associate member of the organization. End of the article. End of page one. Continuing with a section, local briefs. Decatur, alleged shooter arrested. An 18-year-old Decatur man was in custody Tuesday night in connection with the shooting of another teen earlier in the day. Decatur police said an 18-year-old male was shot at about 3:30 p.m. Tuesday in the vicinity of 17th and William Streets. He was transported to a hospital where he was treated for non-life-threatening injuries. Patrol officers and detectives following up on leads made the arrest at 8:10 p.m., said a news release from Lieutenant Shannon Gutierrez-Seal of the Criminal Investigations Bureau. No other information was available Tuesday night. Shelbyville. Cemetery vandalism. Four men were charged Tuesday with vandalizing more than 150 tombstones earlier this month at a rural Shelby County cemetery. Bradley Wright of Shelbyville, Colton Brown of Alma, and Trenton White of Shelbyville are charged with unlawful vandalization of a gravesite related to damage at Ridge Cemetery on Shelby County's Williamsburg Hill. An unnamed juvenile also faces charges related to the incident. The destruction, including some tombstones that weighed more than 1,000 pounds, left area residents upset and angry. Volunteers have been working for the last 2 weeks repairing the damage. A GoFundMe page has been set up for donations. Then in Windsor, new council member. Former city council member Rex Kuntzman was reappointed to the Windsor City Council at a special meeting after the resignation of council member Jeremy Voris. Voris resigned last week as part of the conditions of a plea agreement to charges of official misconduct. Voris was charged with allowing his wife, a former city employee, charge fuel for her personal vehicle to the city's account. Decatur. Gunfire nets arrest. A Decatur man wasn't feeling lucky early Tuesday afternoon after being arrested for weapon possession. The 32-year-old man was arrested early Tuesday after firing three shots outside the Feeling Lucky Bar on Woodford Avenue. Along with the aggravated unlawful use of weapon, the man also was arrested for possession of a weapon by a felon. A witness told Decatur police they heard the three shots go off, followed by a male running eastbound on the north side of the building. The man appeared to put an object into his rear waistband before going into the Mountford Terrace apartment complex. Officers found a person matching the provided description in the apartment's parking lot. A loaded firearm was located near where the witness last saw the man. The gun has been taken in for fingerprints and DNA tests. The man, who has a history of felony possession charges, is currently in Macon County Jail on a $150,000 bond. Pena. Headline says, Pena okays alderman. Ward 4 in Pena has a new alderman after the City Council approved Mayor Steve Sipes' appointment of Diane Bailey last week. Bailey, a former alderman, replaces Debbie Dust, who resigned last month due to health issues. Nice to be back, Bailey said after being sworn in by City Clerk Terry Klein. There is 1 year remaining on the term. Decatur. Easter dinner set. Vinny's Barbecue will be holding its 15th annual Easter dinner for the homeless from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Sunday, March 27th, in Water Street Mission on Water Street. Mount Zion Dancing Classes, and this is the last of the briefs here. The Mount Zion Recreation Department is offering a 6-week dancing class for couples and singles. The cost is $70 for couples or $35 for singles. Spring sessions begin in April. Registration is available at the MountZion.com website or at 864-5424, 864-5424. Hitting with local, This is by Allison Petty from the H&R staff. Seniors put lifetime of spelling to the test. Decatur. Given the friendly nature of the spelling bee, it was fitting that Betty Perry won with the word genteel, G-E-N-T-E-E-L. Perry, 94, emerged the victor after 11 rounds of words among roughly 10 spellers Tuesday at the McKinley Court Care Center. She will advance to the regional level in the Association of Illinois Senior Centers and the Illinois Department of Aging's On Aging's Illinois State Senior Spelling Bee competition. I love spelling, she said. In the fifth grade, I was always the best speller, and my mother was the best speller. As it happens, Perry's daughter is State Representative Sue Scherer, Decatur, Democrat Decatur, whose office sponsored the local bee. Scherer said she never practiced spelling with her mother, but she knew that she would do well. Scherer assured several of the seniors who failed to advance that she wouldn't have known how to spell their words either. I think it's wonderful for them to get their minds off some of their worries and concerns, she said. This is something they can still do now that they used to do when they were little kids in school. The rounds began with easier selections, such as grandma, hallway, and sunglasses, and gradually increased in difficulty. Trapeze, matador, cinnamon, gazebo. Second place finisher Steve Furrow saw the bee advertised in the newspaper and decided to attend. He too will advance to the regional competition. Like most spelling aficionados, Furrow carries the memory of one word he misspelled as a child, embroidery. I was not familiar, had never heard the word as a fifth grader, said Furrow, who still enjoys spelling, and won an adult bee several years ago. I still remember that from when I was 10. Third place finisher Ida Campbell is an avid reader and lover of spelling, who said she enjoyed the event despite missing the word fallacy, F-A-L-L-A-C-Y. I knew the minute I said it afterwards it should have had two L's. I thought of follow, and I thought I should have had two L's in there, said Campbell, 86. Her favorite word, though, is a more positive one, victorious. And as far as Scherer is concerned, that word describes all the participants Tuesday. Everybody's a winner, Scherer told him. Just showing up makes you a winner here, ended this article. Continuing with education, this is by Valerie Wells. Again, St. Teresa Scholastic Bowl team takes second at state. Decatur. Being in Scholastic Bowl has made Devin Niederbrock read the news much more closely. You realize that those little articles, which are important globally but maybe not so much personally, are something you should read, said the St. Teresa High School senior. The St. Teresa team finished second in the state in Scholastic Bowl on Friday in Peoria, losing the top slot to Latin School of Chicago. The trophy they brought home is so big it won't fit in the trophy case, said Robert Malcomicki, a sophomore. We're in Scholastic Bowl and we can't figure out how to get a trophy in the case, he joked. Preparing for a competition when the students have no idea what kind of questions will be asked isn't an exact science. All the students can do is bone up general knowledge in their area of specialty, do practice rounds with past year's questions, and hope they know enough. To prepare, we just memorized a lot of random stuff, said Aaron Sass, team captain. Clarence Velasco saved the team, Aaron said, when he knew the name of the director of Citizen Kane and the first word spoken in the film. Aaron, a senior, said he'd never heard of the film, so he was impressed. Clarence is their pop culture and mythology expert. The answers, by the way, are Orson Welles and Rosebud. Clarence also knew that Rosebud was the protagonist's sled. Four of the eight members are seniors, said Coach Sandra Bronson, so she's losing half her team to graduation. The remaining four members have pledged to participate again next year and are doing their best to recruit students for the team. Teachers are too. Aaron jokes he's a jack of all trades and master of none, while Connor Reardon is their math expert. Devin knows paintings and current events. One of the questions, said Principal Ken Kendrickson, was what color a woman's dress was in a painting, a question he thought was exceptionally difficult, and Devin knew the answer. Robert is the Bible expert. There are more Bible questions in a competition than you might think, he said. Other team members are junior Haley Vemmer, sophomore Sarah Yepsen, and freshman Charlie Smith, Charlie Blackburn, Shirley Syed, Lauren Pugh, and Mary Shupanius. That is the end of that article. It is the end of part one of our reading for Wednesday, March 23rd, 2016, of the Decatur Herald and Review E-Edition. We'll be back shortly.